Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And we are going to talk today about the film career of actress Audrey Hepburn, who had kind of, I think, two lives. What do you think, Mike? I mean, the first part of her life was very, very difficult in World War II, followed by an amazing career in Hollywood.
Well, we should talk about that early life. Let me first note that everything you've ever read or heard about Audrey Hepburn is true. I mean, just the charm, the elegance, the beauty, all those wonderful attributes. I actually met Audrey Hepburn in 1991, so really just a couple years before she died. And she was so gracious and so charming. And when I refer to her as an aristocrat, I don't mean that at all in a kind of like snobby or elitist way. There's a crucial distinction here. She had a kind of natural elegance, genuine poise, incredibly well-spoken, that beautiful speaking voice. I mean, just to listen to that was mesmerizing. And so I was totally charmed by her, and she was everything I was hoping for. And when you think about the difficulty of her early years, both the upbringing in which she was privileged, but then the hardships that she faced, we should probably talk about that for a moment. So let me reprise that, because she's born in 1929, and her parentage is interesting. She's actually born in Belgium, but her father was an English banker, and her mother was a Dutch baroness. She was living in London as a child and studying there. And then her bad fortune was that she was on vacation in Holland just when World War II began. So she actually lived in a Nazi-occupied town, but still managed to study ballet there. So, you know, she could still appreciate the finer things in life, but she really literally went hungry. It was hardship. It was really a challenge for her. So on the one hand, this aristocratic background, and that explains a lot of the natural elegance, I think, and poise and just, you know, all around good manners, if you will. So that's like on the plus side. On the minus side, by way of a challenge, was that, you know, she was living in a small town that was occupied by Nazis, and she was doing her best along with the family to survive. Fortunately, they did, and then they went back to London after the war. So it's a fascinating upbringing with all sorts of things to consider, and those do manifest themselves later in the career in various ways.
You know, she's a very slender person, and, you know, you have to wonder how much malnutrition during World War II contributed to that, because I read where she said that if they had known that they were going to be occupied for 5 years, they would have shot themselves. That's a direct quote. They were doing things like making flour from tulip bulbs to just try to survive and to try to get through that period of time. It's a staggering amount of deprivation. Plus, she actually witnessed things like watching Dutch Jews being put on trains to go to the concentration camps. She saw kids her own age, you know, being taken away. So, you know, very sobering kind of a childhood. It's amazing to grow up and become so poised and self-possessed after beginning like that.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because when I mentioned her upbringing, I talked about, well, on the one hand, you know, really poised and elegant and the kind of thinness that we associate with what, the Duchess of Windsor, and, you know, I'm getting at, you know, you can't be too rich or too thin kind of quotes. But in the case of Audrey Hepburn, it wasn't just like being thin for the sake of being fashionably thin. She was thin because she was near starvation during World War II. I mean, again, it's that mixed equation of, you know, this aristocratic background, but also genuine hardship. And those are things that really shaped her throughout her life, you know, that she would be thin.
But then she had some incredible breaks. So while she's, and I don't know how much you wanted to talk about her life before she came to the United States, but when she was a chorus girl playing Gigi, she was spotted in the audience by Colette, whose, you know, play was based on her book. I mean, who does that get to happen to? And then, of course, her career took off like gangbusters.
Before it took off like gangbusters, she actually had appeared in a number of minor roles. She was in English films, and I always smile, you know, when you think about the Ealing comedies, you know, the Alec Guinness comedies and so on. Watch The Lavender Hill Mob from 1951. I mean, you know, it's a really terrific comedy. It's mostly the guys with their criminal scheming and so on, but in a minor, very minor role, lo and behold, there's Audrey Hepburn. It's like you look up, and oh my goodness, I know her. And so she did some really small roles like that, but you're right. So much is good timing in the sense that, you know, Colette did notice her and asked her to play Gigi on Broadway. And then when she broke through in Hollywood, she was also breaking through on Broadway, not just with Gigi, but she won the Tony Award for Ondine in 1954. And we tend to forget now that she had a considerable stage career at that early phase of her career.
Actually, you know, for someone who had no acting classes, you know, no Lee Strasberg, none of those classic ways to, you know, prove yourself. She is one of 15 people who's won an Academy Award, an Emmy, a Grammy, and a Tony.
Very select company. And again, it's a reminder that she was more versatile than we sometimes tend to recall her for. We think of her for her iconic movie roles, but as we've just been saying, think about her as a theater actor, you know, a Broadway actor, also somebody who, you know, worked in television and recording. And, you know, she really had a very well-rounded career.
Yeah, which is surprising because it doesn't sound like she started off knowing that her whole life that she wanted to do that. I do think it's interesting that she chose Hepburn as a, you know, a stage name. I know people have confused her with Katharine Hepburn all the time, including Givenchy, who thought he was meeting Katharine Hepburn, but then once he met Audrey Hepburn, they created a partnership that was to last through several movies. But why don't we jump into the success story of Roman Holiday?
We should talk about that because this truly was a case of somebody who had a really minor screen career in the early 50s in British films. And, you know, we notice her there, but it's just in a scene or two. And then suddenly, when, you know, Hollywood takes notice, she is hired to co-star with Gregory Peck in Roman Holiday. On the production level, we should note that this film was shot on location in Rome, which was becoming more popular at the time. In other words, Hollywood movies getting out of Hollywood, shooting not just on location, but shooting in Europe. And Roman Holiday was a great, relatively early example of that, because it really benefits from having her, you know, on location. Like when she takes a, you know, she's a princess and she decides to sort of play hooky from royalty, if you will, and she decides to, you know, walk around town as a commoner. What a difference it makes that you actually are in Rome, you know, that it's palpable there. And when she was shooting that film, the people who made it, specifically the director William Wyler, realized that this was a movie star in the making. And indeed, after the movie came out, it had great reviews, did great business, she won the Academy Award as Best Actress. What a great way to come out of the gate. I mean, it's technically speaking, strictly speaking, it's not her screen debut, but it amounts to that, doesn't it? So to give a sense of how she impressed the people she was working with, let me share with you a quote from the director, William Wyler, who's, as he's making the film, he thinks, my goodness, this is a real talent. So here's the quote. As I saw the rushes, I had that rare gut feeling that I was witnessing something very special. She was a princess. She had so much poise, no doubt from her experience as a dancer and from her mother's aristocratic background. But she was also every eager young girl who has ever come to Rome for the first time. And she reacted with so natural and spontaneous an eagerness that I, crusty veteran that I was, felt tears in my eyes watching her. Audrey was the spirit of youth, and I knew that very soon the entire world would fall in love with her, as all of us on the picture did.
That's a great quote, and it also reminds me that they were going to have the poster say, you know, Roman Holiday starring Gregory Peck, and then in small letters, and introducing Audrey Hepburn. And Gregory Peck said, you know, she's going to be a huge star, and you need to make her name as big as mine is on the advertising. Otherwise, I'm going to look like a big jerk.
I've always loved that anecdote, and it really speaks well of Gregory Peck that, you know, he was the star, right? And that he insisted that she get equal billing there. Just as William Wyler realized her talent, so did Gregory Peck. And ironically, that was a very long-lasting friendship between the two of them. In fact, at the outset of our conversation just now, when I mentioned that I had met Audrey Hepburn in 1991, it was at the Kennedy Center where she was there to speak on behalf of one of the honorees at the Kennedy Center Honors, Gregory Peck. So I had a chance to talk with both of them seated together, and the affection between the two of them there was so palpable that these weren't just co-stars from all those decades ago, but just the genuine respect, the real affection they had for each other. So your anecdote about the co-billing, you know, in the film really speaks to his character and to hers.
I agree. I agree. And the movie itself is, you know, it's hard not to, it's hard to resist a movie about, you know, a princess who for a day wants to not be a princess and just see what it's like to be a regular person. And when you're following her and Gregory Peck around Rome, it's like you get to go on a little Roman holiday. You get to see, you know, famous sights and watch two people fall in love. It's delightful for those reasons. But it's so improbable in today's age that somebody of her age and was royal, not having their likeness, you know, splashed all over everything. The idea that she could blend is something that would just be impossible. You think about Diana being chased through the tunnels of Paris. I mean, things have changed so much. It's a sweet fairy tale.
Well, that's the ideal way to express it. You know, even then, there would be enough media awareness that, you know, she's this bored princess who feels like she's in a gilded cage, right? She wants to get out of the palace. She decides to go, not quite slumming, but at least touristing, right? She wants to walk around Rome. And Gregory Peck, of course, is the journalist. He's the writer. He's, you know, hook up with her. And you know, and then it's the interplay between them in terms of who knows what. But to your point directly, you would think that more people on the street would say, doesn't she look familiar? Nowadays, of course, you're absolutely right. It would be increasingly improbable that she could get away with that, to walk around unacknowledged, unrecognized in Rome. But it ultimately speaks to what you very astutely said, namely that the film is essentially a fairy tale. You can pick at it in terms of realism and you know, what's probable and not, but, you know, apply that to a fairy tale, right? At a certain point, you give yourself over to the fairy tale. And it's a really tender quasi-romance, if you will, between the commoner, Gregory Peck, and the royalty. And I got to say this again and again, with Audrey Hepburn, that natural aristocracy. When you think of the princess she plays in the film, there's a kind of naivete, even a kind of innocence to her, an openness, if you will, right? She never takes herself seriously. She's never pompous. She's never lording it over other people, as she's entitled to as a blue blood, right? She really just acts as a genuinely kind and curious person. And those are attributes, of course, as we noted earlier, Audrey Hepburn had. That's what she was like. I mean, you know, talking with her, it was the easiest thing in the world. Though mostly I listened because, as we've mentioned a few times, she was incredibly poised and incredibly well-spoken. I mean, the diction, the proper phrasing, but never in a kind of hoity-toity upper crust way. You know what I mean? Just simply the product of, you know, good breeding, if you will, good education, good manners.
And a good person. I mean, she later would go on to do a lot of humanitarian work with UNICEF, but the character that she, or the persona she created in Roman Holiday, I think is probably a lot like how she was in real life, because she reprised that in almost every role, which is that sort of vulnerable but confident woman, which she carried over into Sabrina. And you know, one thing I was noticing a lot about her movies when I was going back to watch them again were how many times they placed her in Paris as this sort of the perfect Parisian woman, even though, of course, she's British. And she still sort of typifies what I think of as the quintessential Parisian woman, you know, thin, beautiful, coiffed, dressed to the nines, stylish, and in Paris.
It's worth lingering on that point because even though, of course, she's a major Hollywood movie star, biographically and by way of temperament, she is European. You know, we can say she's British, you know, technically, but I would prefer to say that she's continental. And that's sort of an old-fashioned way of describing it, right? Because, you know, when you look at her father's background, you know, which is British, but then her mother's, which is, you know, Dutch, where she lived, how she was brought up. Like so many Europeans, she readily crossed borders, right? You know, when the Nazis occupied, she wasn't able to, but otherwise she was, you know, somebody brought up in Europe that way. And there's a sensibility there that even in her American roles, you can sense that there's something about her that's not exactly Middle Western. You know what I mean? It's not exactly, you know, the American Midwest. There's something that's transatlantic, if you will, or, you know, somehow European. And again, the voice itself, that it's not quite an accent, but there's a sense of real high class upbringing. You know, there's a sense really of somebody with taste and style. And as you said, Marie, that carries over obviously to how her hair is done, the wardrobe she wears, things like that, which are really high fashion. But I keep saying over and over, high fashion and high class, high culture, but not snobby, not elitist at all. That's a crucial point. It's a balancing act, isn't it? To be able to have those attributes, but to not be stuffied and to not lord it over anybody. It's a really delicate balance that she managed to strike.
Yeah, and she does it over and over in every movie. So when you get to Sabrina in 1954 with William Holden and Humphrey Bogart, she plays that role beautifully as a young woman who is, you know, the chauffeur's daughter, who then gets sent, of course, to Paris to learn how to cook. And then she comes back, and then there's this tug of war between the two men over which one is going to end up with her. And it's, again, a charming movie, a love story. It's a Billy Wilder movie, so it has that going for it as well. It also has John Williams in it as the chauffeur. It's nice to see him show up again after seeing him in so many things from Hitchcock.
Yeah, and again, when you describe the film and quite well, again, it's a reminder to us that it's a fairy tale in some ways, right? There are aspects of a Cinderella type story, you know, because in Sabrina, she's not playing royalty. And yet, you know, as we watch the film and as other characters notice her, we realize, you know what, the chauffeur's daughter is something special, isn't she? And she has a lot of the same character traits you and I have just been describing for Princess Anne in Roman Holiday. So she goes from playing an actual princess, which is close to her real background, to playing an American commoner, but someone who's not common at all, if you will, who has such elegance and grace that people notice it. And it's almost like Cinderella being invited to the ball.
Exactly. It is very much the Cinderella being invited to the ball. And then you get that again with, you know, Love in the Afternoon a little bit. Again, Maurice Chevalier, more Paris. You know, you get to the Nun story in 1959, The Unforgiven in 1960, and then you come to Breakfast at Tiffany's in 1961. I think her most iconic role. What do you think, Mike?
I'd have to agree with you. I mean, you know, the two pinnacles of the career really would be Roman Holiday at the outset, and then, you know, as she's a major star, Breakfast at Tiffany's. And I don't want to be boxed in as, well, which do I prefer, one over the other? They're both really terrific films. But I think in terms of the general public, and by that I mean just simply our popular awareness of her, our recollection of her, there's no doubt really that it's Breakfast at Tiffany's. Because when you think about the character she plays, when you think about how she's dressed and so on, that's the quintessential Audrey Hepburn, right?
That is the quintessential Audrey Hepburn right there. And this is where you see the clothing from Givenchy really to its advantage. The opening scene, that little black dress that she's wearing, became iconic instantly. It's still fashionable. And most of the clothes that she wears in that are iconic. If you've ever gone out and bought yourself a Burberry trench coat, that was first made popular by its appearance in Breakfast at Tiffany's.
You know, I've had students who over the years have occasionally written about that film. And it's interesting. These are students who, you know, weren't even born until decades later. And yet when they write about her in terms of the fashions, you know, that young women today admire the look she had then. And you know, that's rare. There aren't that many occasions where you'd go back in film history and say that, you know, a young adult now would look back to this film from the early 1960s and really with great admiration and respect talk about how she's dressed, the image she cuts. It's a kind of eternal fashion statement in some ways. You know, like, you know, the thing about fashion is you go in and out of fashion, right? But somehow she's had this enduring appeal where what was incredibly of the moment in the early 60s, I mean, think about how she dressed, and then think about Jackie Kennedy or something, right? And you really have a sense of what high fashion was then. Well, my goodness, you know, both of those have been enduring icons, haven't they, in terms of really stylish women, really elegant, admirable women.
Although in this movie, she said it was hard for her to do because she's an introvert playing an extrovert. And it is a very extroverted character. It's a little bit of a ditz who can't remember her keys and is planning to try to marry as well as possible the richest but youngest man that is out there. So it's a departure from her sort of everyday person kind of, not, you know, I mean, she was a princess in Roman Holiday, but the rest of her roles are very relatable. I don't know how many people would aspire to be Holly Golightly.
Well, let's talk about the name itself. you know, we're laughing as we say this because if your name is Holly Golightly, what's your personality type likely to be?
Not a shrinking violet.
The stereotypes of naming, right? But a reminder that it's based on a story by Truman Capote, and Capote knew that world very well. And there's a quasi-satirical quality to it. It's not mean-spirited at all, but he has some fun with it. And so does she, because Holly Golightly is kind of scatterbrained in some ways, isn't she? She forgets things, she's flighty, this and that, but in a way that's endearing. And again, we talk oftentimes about a balancing act that Audrey Hepburn strikes in terms of personality traits. Holly Golightly is a perfect example of this, because in many ways, Holly Golightly is naive. You know, that she doesn't know a lot in a formal sense, like educationally, and that she does some foolish things and she forgets things and everything you were mentioning. But by the same token, this Holly-Golightly, who's kind of naive and even foolish, also manages to be rather wise on occasion. She's really very smart at times. And again, that's a very, very difficult balancing act for the actor as much as anyone else. How do you convey those disparate traits? How do you make all that seem of a piece? And she does, right? You never doubt that this is a character who is viable and that you believe in. And yet the individual elements sometimes would seem to be at odds with each other. You know, how can you be naive but also be knowing and wise?
Now, I think we have to mention the fact that Moon River is performed in this movie by her. She sings it herself. And that they did try to say, you know, we're going to have somebody else re-record that for the movie. And she put her foot down and said, no, I really think it is important that it stay the way that it is. And of course, went on to be one of the biggest songs of all time.
Well, it won the Academy Award for, you know, Henry Mancini. And you know, one of his greatest accomplishments was working on this film. I mean, Moon River, again, is one of his eternal songs. I mean, it still registers, it still hits now. And, you know, there were always issues with her in the sense that, you know, she was not really a trained vocalist. And, you know, it would pop up later on with My Fair Lady in terms of, you know, when you cast someone in a movie, should she do her own singing? So I think you make a good point with Breakfast at Tiffany's that that was a jousting point for her oftentimes as to would they allow her to sing or would they want to have somebody dub it?
I don't think it matters that the performance isn't the best, you know, singing you've ever heard. It's a personal kind of a song. It's meant to make her more endearing. I think it works in the movie.
It's character driven, isn't it?
I mean, it is.
Right. So, you know, technically there are better singers, but so what? You know what I mean? It expresses her character and that's what counts.
Now, some things I think are watching it in 2020. There are some things I think don't work quite as well as they probably did in 1961. One is the idea that, you know, you would just let somebody, total stranger, into your apartment to use the phone, which, you know, you can't find for a minute because it's closed up in a suitcase because it was ringing and bothering you. That seems awfully trusting for New York. The other is the character of Mickey Rooney as the Asian man who lives upstairs, who's played for laughs and stereotypes. What do you think, Mike? Does that work in 2020?
I've had to directly confront this in the classroom because I teach a course on Hollywood in the 1960s. And one of the films I use is Breakfast at Tiffany's. And as a teacher, I try to turn it to advantage, make it a learning moment, you know, for all of us. Because the film itself is so innocent and just so good-natured. And yet within it, there's this really risible, really, really awful stereotype. Mickey Rooney at his most Mickey Rooney-ish, overbearing, right? He plays this upstairs neighbor. And on the one hand, he's only in the film for, you know, a matter of minutes. It's a supporting role, right? But on the other hand, every moment on screen is excruciating, and it's so at odds with the rest of the film. It's a reminder that that kind of racial stereotype still was common. So again, as a classroom instructor, I always think the best thing to do is hit it straight on. Don't nervously dance around it. You know, when you're going to talk about the film, just hit that right on, because films are cultural documents, aren't they? And they speak to the moment. And I always am up against this because I'll be using films from throughout film history. And, you know, like 99% of the film is fine in terms of our cultural values and yada, yada. But then there'll be a scene or a character or something that's like, oh, my goodness, you know, what is this? So we're not talking about like outright egregious examples of films that are, you know, considered racist or dubious in any way. We're talking about films that almost anyone would enjoy. But then you get that moment, that scene, that character, that whatever. I'll give a quick sideline example. When I do a course on Hollywood in the 1920s, we watch Harold Lloyd's Safety Last. A really, really funny, really brilliant film. And yet, you know, there are two or three scenes with stereotypical characters. And in terms of race relations and so on, it's like, really, whoa, you know, it's like, what do you make of this? And again, I say, hit it straight on. I mean, talk about the cultural values of an era and things that nowadays would never pass muster. You say, oh my goodness, you can't have that character. That's so stereotypical. You know, it should be cut from the film. And yet I say, well, no, watch it as a complete film and realize that, you know, most of it is delightful, but there are things in it that are really going to be disturbing, and use it as a teachable moment, you know, in terms of, well, what were the values then? Why would it have gone in? You know, and people would have watched that scene and not thought anything of it. You know what I mean? They would have laughed at it and it just moved on. We watch it now thinking, you know, get out the scissors, cut out that scene. Or some people would say, don't even watch the film. And I think in Breakfast at Tiffany's, we had that discussion in the classroom. you know, the students and I joined them, you know, the Mickey Rooney character is so awful. What do you do about it? And I say, well, we'll talk about it and realize it does mar the film a bit. Yeah.
And when you're watching it, you know that it's meant to be funny and that it probably was funny in 1961, which is why it makes it a little cringeworthy to watch it and have it fall flat in an otherwise perfect movie. Are there any other Audrey Hepburn's movies you want to highlight, Mike, before we have to sign off?
I want to quickly mention the fact that she continued working, you know, into the 60s and 70s, and in some of the later roles, acknowledges that, you know, she's now a middle-aged actress. Always a sensitive point in Hollywood, right? You know, she was always known as being young and innocent, that, or, you know, the early Audrey Hepburn, certainly Breakfast at Tiffany's and Back to Roman Holiday. And when you look at some of the later roles, like Two for the Road in 1967 with Albert Finney, Wait Until Dark in 1967, Robin and Marian in 1976 with Sean Connery. When you look at the characters she plays there, these are directly presented as, you know, middle-aged women with romantic lives of their own. In other words, she really goes with that. She doesn't try to play younger than she is, if you, you know, follow my drift there. And there's a kind of maturity in her that really speaks well. I wish she had worked more often in later years, but as you know, increasingly, she was doing less screen acting and more humanitarian work. And you know, God bless her for that, but, you know, the work of UNICEF and so on was really valuable. But as you do all that philanthropic work around the world, obviously you're not on a Hollywood movie set as often.
The other thing I think I want to mention about Audrey Hepburn's style sense is this sort of uniform look that she had later, which was slim black pants, black turtleneck, and ballerina flats. And remember that this is, again, an era where women wearing slacks, as Katharine Hepburn would have said, was really unusual. So the fact that she sort of pioneered that sort of almost beatnik look, I think was it's worth mentioning because it's still stylish, kind of like all the other things that she wore, they're still stylish.
So there's the point of connection. You've got slacks in common between Katharine Hepburn and Audrey Hepburn.
Now, she passed away in 1993, I guess 2 years after you met her, Mike. I think she was 63 years old, which is kind of young. And I can't remember which actor at her funeral said that Audrey Hepburn was gone and a silver bell had been silenced.
Audrey Hepburn was 61 when I met her, and she died a couple years later of cancer. So it was really, really heartbreaking, you know, to die relatively young like that. And, you know, because in our memories, of course, she is always young, you know, and even when she plays more mature roles, there's still that kind of elfin, you know, really beautiful image she projected, and yet she did not enjoy a long life, it's true.
Now, in terms of other actresses who maybe are in that same vein, Anne Hathaway reminds me a little bit of Audrey Hepburn, and so does Keira Knightley. You know, both very slender fashion icons with that sort of vulnerable, winsome, elfin look to them.
I agree with you, but in some ways it's an unfair burden. Imagine you're a young actress today and somebody says you're sort of like Audrey Hepburn, but at some point, wouldn't you think, well, but I'm not, you know,
right.
what a high standard to meet, you know, it's kind of daunting to think about that because Audrey Hepburn was so distinctive.
And one of a kind. Well, that brings us to the end of our segment. Don't forget to check out our other episodes on dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. And we will see you at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.